Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Abraham Lincoln was a great orator who spoke to Americans of their mystic chords of memory and the better angels of our nature. He was also a do-what-it-takes leader who presided over the most trying years in all of American history. Now, on the 200th anniversary of his birth, another president out of Illinois who reveres Lincoln is at the helm. What might Obama learn from Abraham? This hour, On Point, we'll look at Lincoln's style of leadership in the White House. You can join the conversation. Do you think of Lincoln as a distant marble statue or a real and relevant leader now? What should Obama learn from Lincoln? Joining us today from Dallas, Texas, is James McPherson. He's professor emeritus of history at Princeton University and one of America's leading historians of the Civil War. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1989 for his Civil War history, Battle Cry of Freedom. He's the author of two new works on Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, a short biography, and Tried by War, Abraham Lincoln is Commander-in-Chief, which just today won the Lincoln Prize for Outstanding Civil War Scholarship. James McPherson, congratulations and welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Jack's written about 19th century American history himself, most recently in his book, Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900. Great to have you with us, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and a warm welcome to you, Professor McPherson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Beatty.
It's great to have you both. And I have to admit my prejudices right out of the gate. As an Illinois kid who grew up with the Lincoln story all around, I have always more than admired this president, not least because of the kind of stamp he gave to that coming up from rail splitting. You quote him, Jim McPherson, in your book, of course, saying, this was in New Haven, Connecticut, when his son was at school at Phillips Exeter. He was on his way up the political ladder, but he knew where he came from. And he said, I am not ashamed to confess, this was in New Haven, that 25 years ago I was a hired laborer mauling rails at work on a flatboat, just what might happen to any poor man's son. But in free states, he said, an ambitious man can better his condition because there's no such thing as a freeman being fatally fixed for life in the condition of hired laborer. As an Illinois kid who grew up swinging an axe and a hoe and all the rest, that always really spoke to me, Jim McPherson. And I guess that was always potent political symbolism for Abe Lincoln as well.
It certainly was, and it was specifically aimed at the question of the expansion of slavery into territories. That was the big issue in 1860, and what Lincoln was saying in this speech was that in free states, where all workers were free, they could move up the ladder from humble beginnings, as he had done, and get ahead with hard work, education, application of their talents. But what he was saying was that in the slave states, most labor was fatally fixed in that status as for life. That is the status of slavery. And that if slavery was allowed to go into the territories like Kansas, which was the big issue at that time, it would cut out free labor. It would keep out free labor, and there would be no such opportunities as he had in the free state of Illinois. So this was very much part of the slavery controversy that was building up to a climax in 1860 and would explode after Lincoln's election with the Civil War.
We want to look at Lincoln's leadership style in the White House, but I want to get your beat first just on Obama's fascination with this prisoner. He's not the first. Teddy Roosevelt was sworn in wearing a ring that contained a strand of Lincoln's hair, and Woodrow Wilson, Richard Nixon, talked a lot about Lincoln. What do you make of Obama's almost Lincoln mania, Jim McPherson?
Well, I think that the symbolism of Obama being elected as the first African-American president and taking office just 3 weeks before we celebrate the bicentennial of Abraham Lincoln's birth, it carries a wonderful message. It really closes the circle from the beginning with the abolition of slavery during the Civil War under Lincoln's leadership over 100 and almost 150 years until the promise that any poor man, any man coming from humble beginnings, from unlikely beginnings, can get ahead in America and can even be elected president. It happened with Lincoln, and of course it has happened with Obama, and the symbolism of a black man being elected and taking office 200 years after the great emancipator issued the Emancipation Proclamation. That is, I think, hugely symbolic for American society and American politics.
Barack Obama launched his presidential campaign famously at the old State House in Springfield, Abraham Lincoln's hometown. When he came to Washington for his inauguration, followed the train route that Lincoln used. When he needed a Bible for that swearing-in, he picked the one that Lincoln has used on Inauguration Day, modeled the luncheon after Lincoln's favorites, right down to the seafood stew. And here he was last night, President Obama, at a rededication of Ford's Theater in Washington, where Lincoln was assassinated, of course, in 1865. Here's President Barack Obama there, speaking about the 16th president's determination to keep the country united.
It is this sense of unity that is so much a part of Lincoln's legacy. For despite all that divided us, North and South, black and white, he had an unyielding belief that we were at heart one nation and one people. And because of Abraham Lincoln and all who've carried on his work in the generation since, that is what we remain today.
Jack Beatty, here's a president who refers to Lincoln at every turn, very often. And we're going to talk about Lincoln's leadership style, what he might materially learn from it. But first of all, just what about this reemergence of Lincoln? Was it inevitable with an African-American president out of Illinois? Or do you feel something more, some further kinship here?
Well, you know, I think that Obama is a sort of avatar of what Lincoln was talking about in that New Haven speech, what he called the right to rise. Mm-hmm. That the right to rise was something that was possible in the northern states of the Union and there only in the world. And with Obama, not only because he's an African-American, but because his circumstances in life were exceedingly humble, single parent family, his mother at one point had to go on food stamps, a young man who rose by his abilities in the law and in writing. It is a Lincoln-esque story, so I think there's an appropriateness just in the sort of self-making power in both of these men.
Jim McPherson, you know the history inside and out. We're going to come to key examples along the way, but begin with just the character of Lincoln that made him ultimately magnetic, that put him in the White House, that led him to his successes there. I mean, this is a guy who had quite a career before he landed in Washington, a lot in the law, as it happens, actually lived with my family for a while in New Salem, Illinois, the Camerons. Polly Cameron was, I don't know, a great something aunt of mine. Family holds that up with great pride. But you write that he was already, as a lawyer, was a very effective with juries because of his humor and his tendency to focus on the main point and let a lot of other things slide away.
Yes, that's right. All of Lincoln's legal colleagues wrote about that. In a trial, he would often concede minor points to the opposition, and part of that, I think, was strategic. He was trying to lull them into complacency and then would reserve the main point on which the entire case turned. He would pounce, and he was very effective with juries, I think, because he came out of the same kind of rural background as jurors in Illinois, and most jurors in Illinois in the 1840s and 50s and the circuit that he traveled in central Illinois. He could speak to them in their own language. He could explain issues in layman's terms, not legal jargon. And as a consequence, he was very effective as a lawyer in the kind of typical day-to-day cases that constituted most of his practice. But by the 1850s, he was also involved in major cases concerning railroads, concerning commercial enterprises of one sort or another. And I think in handling those cases, he showed another side of his qualities, which served him well as president, and that is his deep study of the issues. He would spend many hours going over every aspect of a problem. He would inform himself of the opposition's case so that he could anticipate any of the opposition's arguments. I think Lincoln was not a quick study. He was a deep study. He would examine all sides of a question. He would take a long time to make up his mind. He would listen or study all points of view. And that's a habit that he carried over into his presidency, and I think is one factor that accounted for his effective leadership. He never went off half-cocked. And sometimes, as in the case of his law partner, William Herndon, Herndon was often impatient with the amount of time it took Lincoln to prepare a case, to make up his mind, to decide what his argument was going to be. But in the end, I think that paid off because Lincoln never got caught by surprise because he had examined all sides of the question.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Abraham Lincoln and his leadership style in the White House on the 200th anniversary today of his birth with a new president from Illinois in the White House who reveres the 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. James McPherson is with us, author of Tried by War, Abraham Lincoln as Commander-in-Chief, his latest, Pulitzer Prize winner for his history, Battle Cry of Freedom on the Civil War era. Jack Beatty's here as well, author of Age of Betrayal. Here's President Obama at a town hall meeting in Fort Myers, Florida on Tuesday with the Florida governor at his side, citing Abraham Lincoln as an example of how to focus on the country's future, even in times of crisis.
Governor Crist mentioned Abraham Lincoln. He, in the middle of the Civil War, in the midst of all this danger and peril, what did he do? He helped move the Intercontinental Railroad. He helped to start land-grant colleges. He understood that even when you're in the middle of crisis, you've got to keep your eye on the future.
Sounds like Rahm Emanuel there. There's opportunity in crisis. Let's begin to hear from our listeners. David in Iowa City. Iowa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There is no doubt that Abraham Lincoln was an amazing historical figure, and he accomplished great things in holding the country together and a lot of other things. But I do wonder how much of the story that most of us know about Abraham Lincoln is mythology. How much do we need to be reminded of how human he was? And I'm thinking of, you know, how he struggled with depression and some of the struggles that we hear he had with his wife and things like that. But the greatness part of it, he is great, but do we make him greater than he really was?
It's a great question to start the conversation with Jim McPherson. How about it? There's always the risk with historical figures that we make a myth bigger than the man. In Lincoln's case, how do you look at that?
Well, there certainly is a temptation on the part of authors and other people who address the public to simplify the story, turn it into unabashed good against unabashed evil, and to mythologize the great hero, Abraham Lincoln. I think that happens in children's literature about Lincoln. It's happened in some of the hagiographic biographies. But I think most of the serious work that's being done on Lincoln and all of the biographies and other books about Lincoln that are appearing in this year of his bicentennial really do try to humanize him. They talk about his struggles with depression. They talk about the difficulties of his marriage. They talk about his failures in his early political efforts. And I think that, in a sense, makes Lincoln all the more appealing. But all the more great because he was a human being and not a marble statue who struggled with the same kinds of problems of frustration during the war. In the book I wrote about Lincoln as Commander in Chief, he experienced repeated frustration with many of his military commanders. He couldn't get them to do what he wanted to do. He sometimes lost his temper with them, lost his cool. But nevertheless, he still managed to come out ahead in the end, and I think that that's really how we should understand Abraham Lincoln, not the marble man who sits there at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, or in bronze statues scattered around the country, in fact, scattered around the world, not just in the United States. And there is a tendency, because he is enshrined in these, in this sculpture and in the heroic image, to think of him as some kind of a god or demigod rather than a struggling human being. And I think that is really the goal of good history writing and good biographical writing, is to make him human so that ordinary humans like the rest of us can identify with his struggles, with his problems, with his ability to overcome those problems.
Jack, I want to get to the issue of how he addressed real problems, questions in office. But this issue of man versus myth is huge, whether it's on the Lincoln Memorial or what, they're putting out new pennies. Lincoln's still on the front, but on the back of the penny, it'll be that, at least on one of them, that little tiny cabin in Hodgenville, Kentucky, where he was born. How do you look at the man versus myth question here, Jim?
Well, you know, when you find something out that that doesn't fit, that's discrepant with the glorious Lincoln, it gives you a start. Some years ago, I was borrowing in the library, and I came across a book called Further Letters of Abraham Lincoln. And I'm going through it. And there's a letter there to an editor in Illinois in 1858, asking this fellow to start up a German language newspaper for the new immigrants there, and in that newspaper to boom Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And it contained a check from Lincoln to this fellow, and it said, and of course, I don't want to be mentioned. I don't want my ownership of the paper to be mentioned or my interest in it to be mentioned. Just go ahead and do what you need to do. And that fellow became ambassador to, I don't know, Tonga or something when he was in the White House.
Well done, sir.
Well done. I mean, I looked at that and I said, oh, my heavens, that doesn't fit with the St. Abe picture. But yes, you don't get to the top of the greasy pole by, you know, without being capable of such things.
Well, Jim McPherson, how about exactly this combination of principle, very high principle that he appealed to Americans to observe ultimately, and very down and dirty practicality when necessary?
Well, Lincoln was above all a politician. Even before he became a lawyer, he ran for the Illinois legislature the first time in 1832 when he was only 23 years old. He was defeated on that occasion, but on the next election he won, and he won four terms in the Illinois legislature, and from then on, he was a political creature. He was ambitious to rise, not only in his profession.
To make something of himself, to be remembered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be remembered. The Abraham Lincoln of history, even the Abraham Lincoln of myth, would not exist were it not for his political skills and his political acumen. And Jack Beatty has just mentioned one example of that. But he was not above lobbying. He was not above. He was in the Illinois legislature. He was a member of what was called the Long Nine. These were the representatives from Sangamon County, where Springfield is located, and all of them were at least 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. That's why they were called the Long Nine.
Right.
They engaged in all kinds of log-rolling politics to get the Illinois Capitol moved from Vandalia, which was in southern Illinois and remote from most of the population centers, to Springfield, where, of course, they all lived, including Lincoln. And he showed his political skills as a floor leader for the Whig Party in that enterprise in the 1830s when he was still in his 20s, and I think he practiced those skills and never would have become president had it not been for that. So the Lincoln that we know as the great statesman, the savior of the Union, the emancipator of the slaves, would never have existed were it not for the way he knew how to play the political game, to climb up the greasy pole.
On the other hand, he was called Honest Abe, and presumably not for no reason. I maybe too lightly used the phrase down and dirty. I mean, what was he seen as a principled politician, even as he played politics hard if necessary?
Well, certainly as opponents in politics, the Democrats, people like Stephen Douglas, who was his main opponent in the 1850s, thought that he played down and dirty on some occasions. He got the name Honest Abe from an early period of his life when he lived in New Salem and was partner in a store there, which went bankrupt when his partner basically drank up all the profits and then took it on the lam and left. And Lincoln was left with all of the debts of the store. By Illinois law at that time, he was only, since he was a partner, he was only liable for half of those debts. But he said that he would repay them all. And it took him years to pay it off. In fact, he used to joke about this debt as his national debt. And I think it was for that reason initially that he was called Honest Abe. I think some of his political opponents would have raised their eyebrows sometimes at the Honest Abe image. But I don't think there was anything dishonest in the way he played the political game. He was this subsidy of the German newspaper, the actual purchase of the German newspaper. Mm-hmm. There's nothing dishonest with that. And that's the way journalism worked in the 1850s. Mm-hmm. Almost all the newspapers were partisan political newspapers. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was struck by when Lincoln had first been elected to the presidency. I was thinking about Obama as I read in your new biography. There was so much concern about the Union in the months before he actually took office. People afraid things were falling apart. A lot of pressure on him to get out and make public statements during that interim period. Sort of panicky advice. He should say something to reassure the South. And you write that he was already on record many times saying he had no constitutional power, no intention to interfere with slavery in the states where it existed. He wrote, "I have said this so often already that a repetition of it is but mockery bearing an appearance of weakness." He was very attuned to how his statements would be perceived. As he got into the arena, he went on to saying that he would have been willing to repeat these statements if there were no danger of encouraging bold, bad men who are eager for something upon which to base new misrepresentations, men who would like to frighten me or at least to fix on me the character of timidity and cowardice. Very aware of image and what statements he was making.
That's quite true, and I think Obama may have taken a leaf from that, because you'll recall that during the interim between his election and his inauguration, on several key issues faced by the United States government, Obama said, we only have one president at a time, and George Bush is still president. I don't want to say anything that might undercut the president's ability to lead the country. And that's basically what Lincoln was saying, even though James Buchanan, during this four-month interlude — in those days, the president was not inaugurated until March 4th, and so there were 4 months of crisis and drift. Mm-hmm. During the lame duck period. But Lincoln's concern was that whatever he said publicly would be subject to distortion, misrepresentation. Somebody would find something in that, saying, oh, he's backed down from his earlier position, or this is a provocative statement that's just going to inflame the situation and make it worse. So I think he made the right decision to remain silent during that period. He actually did write letters to friends in the South, for example, Alexander Stevens, who eventually became vice president of the Confederacy, whom Lincoln had known when they both served in Congress back in the 1840s, trying to reassure Stevens and asking him to extend this reassurance to others that he had no intention of moving against slavery in the states where it already existed, which, of course, he was being charged by Southerners with being an abolitionist. He was a black Republican, which was the way in which the Democrats tried to tar the Republicans at that time.
Meaning?
Well, that they supported black rights, mm-hmm. They thought more of the slave than they did of the free worker. The Democrats played the race card unabashedly, unapologetically. And they were trying to tarnish the Republicans with this image, especially in the South, that they were just chafing at the bit to move into the South, to send all kinds of John Browns to provoke slave uprisings in the South. Any number of wild charges were being made against Lincoln, and he was quite concerned not to say anything that could in any way, shape, or form give his detractors, his critics, his adversaries an opportunity to expand on those accusations.
Let's go to the first big decision he had to make once he was in the White House, Jim McPherson, and it came. Famous incident. Every American who's had junior high school history knows about it. Fort Sumter. And could you lay out what was facing this new president in that southern location?
Well, Fort Sumter was the United States fort to protect Charleston in the Charleston Harbor. It was as yet incomplete in 1860, 1861, but almost complete. And the garrison of about 80 soldiers, commanded by Major Robert Anderson, had moved in moved the garrison to Fort Sumter from a weaker position, Fort Moultrie, on the day after Christmas, 1860. And these 80 soldiers in the fort, which was actually built to accommodate 600, so it's a symbolic force more than anything else, with the flag, the American flag, flying over this installation in the harbor of the most secessionist of cities in the most secessionist of states. So it's a provocative symbol for both sides. As long as the American flag flew over Fort Sumter, Lincoln could maintain at least some symbolic semblance of sovereignty over the state of South Carolina and, by implication, the other states that had seceded. But as long as that American flag flew over Fort Sumter, it tended to make a mockery of the professions of South Carolina and the new Confederate government that they were sovereign over all of their territory. So it was really a flashpoint.
And so we had the dilemma of how to do something about this without being seen as being the one who started a war, the war.
That's exactly right. And the first document he saw after he became president on the day after his inauguration was a letter from Major Anderson saying that they would run out of supplies in a few weeks. And if they weren't resupplied, they'd have to abandon the fort. So he was confronted right away, the first day in office, with the decision of what to do. He consulted his cabinet. He consulted General-in-Chief Winfield Scott. He consulted all kinds of political leaders and other military leaders. At first, most of the advice he got, especially from his Secretary of State, William H. Seward, who had expected to be president and did expect to run this administration until Lincoln made it clear that he was going to run it, their advice was to pull out in order to preserve the peace. And Lincoln leaned that way for a while, but he came to recognize that if he did that, that would be a de facto acknowledgment of the sovereignty of the Confederacy.
On the other hand, if he went in guns blazing, he had started the war. We have 42 seconds before a break here. What did he do? What was his way out?
What he decided to do was to notify the Confederate officials that he was going to send food for hungry men, just supplies. And that put the burden of deciding whether or not to stop those supplies coming in by force on the Confederate shoulders, and it forced them either to allow the supplies in, which would be a recognition of United States sovereignty, or to stop it, which would put the burden of having started the war on their shoulders. They did the latter, and that united the North.
Ingenious in that he hadn't fired the first shot. Nevertheless, the war came, but with a united North, because Jack Lincoln was not seen as having acted rashly in making it happen.
Yes, and he practically clapped his hands over it, you know. I mean, the Civil War begins, and he's delighted, not that the war begins, but because of the way it began.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Abraham Lincoln and his leadership style in the White House on the 200th anniversary today of his birth, talking about it at a time when we have a new president from Illinois who reveres A. Lincoln. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McPherson joins us from Dallas, Texas today. Jack Beatty's here. Let's take a couple calls from Derby Line, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello. Tom, thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to comment, and I'll wait for your answer offline. Mm-hmm. I would like to say that it's refreshing to have somebody like President Obama take a page from Abraham Lincoln, who was a personal hero, and maybe mix it up a little bit with John Kennedy, another man that they both shown that they're human. So maybe we can all learn from that, and maybe Obama will be an extraordinary politician. I'd like to hear what you think.
Great. So bravo for drawing on that one, or maybe two, and let me get another call. We'll look at it, Mike. Bob in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was talking to some friends a couple of weeks ago, and we were having a conversation, and we commented on the fact that when Lincoln came into his presidency, the country was amazingly divided. And one of my friends joked and said, and we're not, you know, poor versus rich, Democrats versus Republicans, for gay marriage, against gay marriage, you know, for stem cell, against stem cell, for the bailout, against the bailout. And we all comment also on the fact we felt like anybody who is in this position, who is actually looking at history, is going to be doing us a better service, because we felt like with the Bush administration, while we watched that administration do certain things, some of us were old enough to remember Vietnam and to say, why would we, you know, enter a country that way, as ill-prepared as we were? Didn't anybody learn, you know, from the history of that? So, you know, it's just my comment, and I just have great solace in the fact that he is looking at how things have been done, and hopefully he will learn from that.
Bob, thanks very much for that. Jack Meade, let me come first to you on this notion of listeners taking comfort in having a president at some level who is reaching back this far to whatever his warts, a great president. It's been a while since we've really felt that, certainly so explicitly in the White House, and that for this time. And then are Bob in Boston and his pals wondering if, you know, maybe we've still got again have a very divided nation that could use some A. Lincoln-style attention?
Well, you know, I think that Lincoln's moment and Obama's moment have this in common. The forces of conservatism in both cases were in abeyance. In the 1850s, all the measures the Whig and Republican parties stood for, the tariff, the Homestead Act, the land-grant colleges, mm-hmm. the River and Harbors Bill, the infrastructure spending, and above all, the Pacific Railroad, all of those were either vetoed by Democratic presidents or killed by Democratic Congresses. The slaveocracy had a grip on the national government. Well, with secession, all that went away. And there was this moment when
Weren't in the voting
they weren't,
part of
they
country
weren't there.
Anymore.
That's right. And so all of these programs could pass. And, you know, what? And I think Obama alluded to some of them. And one historian has called these programs the blueprints for the future. But they could only have been put out there as blueprints because the side of states' rights, of small government, the critics, the people who say that's paternalism to have government doing so much, that was all to the side so the Republicans could take advantage of their moment, just as Obama, I think, does have a moment here with a very weakened Republican Party and a conservative movement that has lost its ideological elan.
And Jim McPherson, what about our caller from Boston wondering if maybe in some way we do have national divisions tantamount, well, comparable? Certainly not as not states seceded, certainly not civil war, but nevertheless, real divisions here. Do you see a dynamic, a comparable dynamic at any level?
Well, all through American history, there have been divisions on mm-hmm. issues like the Homestead Act, like the Second Bank of the United States, which was vetoed by President Andrew Jackson back in 1832, divisions on the tariff, divisions on infrastructure spending. These are the bread and butter issues of American politics, going right back to Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson dueling over some of the same kinds of issues in George Washington's administration. That is, I think, quite different from the division faced by Lincoln in 1861, when half of the country, one-third of its population, left the United States in anger. And basically challenged the United States to a war that turned out to be by far the most deadly as far as Americans were concerned in our history. That's of an altogether different level of division, so that what we're seeing now or have seen in the past several years of division, of deadlock in gridlock in government mm-hmm. between Republicans, so-called incivility of American politics in Congress, that doesn't compare in any way, shape, or form with what was going on in the 1850s and the 1860s, when congressmen from the North and South were actually drawing weapons on each other on the floor of the Senate or the floor of the House.
And mounting armies. So we're at a different scale. It's not existential, though with the economy rocking the way it has, it can feel existential some days. Nevertheless, maybe lessons to be drawn. Let's point to another some other Lincoln decision points, Jim McPherson. There were some real setbacks early in the war. August 1962, big Confederate victory at the Second Battle of Bull Run. When the setbacks came, how did this president deal?
Well, I think Lincoln faced two major problems as president and as commander-in-chief. The first was to come up with some kind of strategy for military victory and find the commanders who were willing to carry out that strategy, willing and able to carry out that strategy. And in what was called the Western Theater out in Kentucky and Tennessee and Mississippi, they enjoyed quite a bit of success from early on in the war. But in the theater that attracted the most attention, Virginia, the Eastern Theater, Lincoln encountered repeated frustration and failure. One of the low points was the Second Battle of Bull Run. He had to deal with that until he could finally find not only the right strategy for victory, but also the right commander to carry it out, which he finally got with Ulysses S. Grant in 1864. The other big issue that he faced as president and commander-in-chief was what to do about slavery. Hmm. Slavery had brought on the war in the first place. Lincoln's initial concern was to keep the border slave states in the Union. They had not yet seceded, and he was afraid they would if he moved prematurely against slavery. But at the same time, he was under a lot of pressure from members of his own party to move against slavery. If the Union somehow was preserved with slavery still in it, it would continue to be a contentious issue that would continue to divide the country and maybe bring on another war. It was clear that the slaves were the principal labor force of the Confederacy and the principal logistical support for Confederate armies. And so Lincoln, about the time of this low point in military operations in Virginia, the Second Battle of Bull Run, the 7 days battles a month earlier in June and July, mm-hmm. Made the decision to issue an Emancipation Proclamation, probably the most historic and important of all the decisions he made. And that turned the war into something quite different from what it had been at the start. It became a war not merely to restore the Union, because that would be a Union with slavery still in it, but a war to give that Union a new birth of freedom, as he said at Gettysburg. And clearly, that was a decision of enormous historical consequence.
Jim, let me get a call right on this point, if you'd be so kind, from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl's calling. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Very well.
Well, I've always wondered, was there any truth to whether Lincoln would have kept slavery to keep the Union together or abolish it to keep the Union together?
James McPherson.
Well, he said in his famous public letter to Horace Greeley, also in August 1862, that if he could save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, he would do it. If he could save it by freeing all the slaves, he would do that. If he could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, he would do that. And I think he was expressing his real opinion then. Interestingly enough, though, he had already written an early draft of the Emancipation Proclamation. So he had already made up his mind that to win this war and to save the Union, he was going to have to issue a proclamation that declared at least some of the slaves free. And he was using this letter as a way of preparing public opinion for that announcement, which came a month later.
But what does that letter to Greeley say about his commitment to high principle, or were these, in his mind, simply two competing high principles, national unity versus emancipation?
The highest principle for him, at least for his public statement at that time, was the national, saving the nation, saving the national union. But he had already come to the conclusion that this was going to require at least some degree of emancipation. And I think this letter to Greeley was really a tactic that he was so good at, which was preparing public opinion for a policy he'd already decided on. I think, in a way, I think that the Emancipation Proclamation freed Abraham Lincoln as well as the slaves. Maybe it freed him more effectively than it did the slaves, in the sense that he had always been anti-slavery. He said, if slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I hate slavery as much as any abolitionist. But his presidential oath, his office, his official responsibility as president, had been to uphold the Constitution, which supported slavery. Now that he had found a way to strike against slavery, it emancipated him from the contradiction between his personal anti-slavery convictions and his official belief that he could not act on those convictions. Now he had found a way to act on them through what he saw as his war powers as commander-in-chief to seize enemy property, in this case slaves, being used to wage war against the United States. That cut the Gordian knot, that concept of war powers, and that, I think, was crucial not only to bringing an ultimate end to slavery, which, of course, took the Constitutional Amendment, the 13th Amendment, but also winning the war.
Jack Beatty, let's take a leap right here, then, to Obama's challenges. And I don't know if this is a comparable tension, but maybe. On the one hand, Obama and the country want him to save the economy, kind of whatever that takes. On the other hand, he talked all through the campaign about a series of policy changes, changes to the texture of American life that he would like to make. Now, if he's reading Lincoln at night, do you imagine him reading, you know, go with the big goal first, save the union, save the economy, and if we can make the other changes, good, but maybe not? Or could he take another lesson from Lincoln, Jack?
I think that Obama's dilemma is the tension between reform, his bigger picture, and recovery, his immediate task. And I think what he's been saying again and again, I'm unwilling to sacrifice reform to recovery. I am going to continue on my, at least with one foot in the future, while we deal with this problem now. And that is, I think, what Lincoln did with his domestic program. And it's certainly what Roosevelt did in the New Deal. I think there Roosevelt might well be his motto, his model, who, you know, many people said you've sacrificed recovery for reform. And perhaps he did, perhaps he didn't. But the fact is the reform, Social Security, all the rest, they're still on the books. And I think Obama wants something similar.
Let's go to John in Richmond, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello. Hi. To your guests. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I guess what I admire most about Lincoln is his growth in the presidency, where he started, obviously, trying to deal with the crisis and ended up mending the union. And the lesson I feel for today would be he took his purpose, took all sorts of advice and criticism, kept to his goal, and then used the appropriate means in order to achieve that goal. There was no way he could politically free the slaves at the beginning of the war, but by the time of the proclamation, it became a necessity.
He migrated with time and thinking, and in the face of those challenges, our time is so short. But Jim McPherson, maybe you could take us to one more decision point. And we've just got a couple of minutes here, but I think it's revealing. Summer of 1864, Union morale at a very low point. Politicians, generals urging Lincoln to compromise with peace, with the Confederacy, back off from the Emancipation Proclamation, and Lincoln refusing, despite everybody's assumption that he would lose in 1864, his reelection campaign, if he didn't do something. But he hung in there, and it took events to save him in that instance, Jim McPherson.
Well, that's true. I think one of the great crises of his presidency was the rising demand for peace, almost peace at any price, in the summer of 1864, when the Northern people, who had been so so high in their expectations of imminent victory, when the spring campaigns led by Grant and Sherman began in May of 1864, but had bogged down by July and August with enormous casualties, especially in Virginia, it looked like victory was farther away than ever, and even if it could be achieved, was it worth the cost? And Lincoln came under enormous pressure to back off from emancipation in the hope that maybe the Confederates, if he backed off, might negotiate some kind of an end of the war that would ultimately lead to reunion. I don't think they would have, and neither did Lincoln, but he nevertheless came under enormous pressure to test that issue. But he refused. He said of emancipation and of the Emancipation Proclamation, the promise being made must be kept. And I think in a way that was his greatest moment as president, because he was really saying, I'm not going to sacrifice this high principle for temporary expediency, which might not work in restoring peace in any case.
And then came the cable from Sherman, Atlanta has fallen, the politics all changed.
Yes, that changed it. Atlanta is ours and fairly won. A very short cable from Sherman on September 3rd, 1862 changed everything around. Now victory looked possible and it looked imminent. And Lincoln was triumphantly reelected. And he had stayed the course and showed that staying the course was the right thing to do and the victorious thing to do.
Leadership style matters. Events matter, too. We'll go out with Lincoln and Liberty, a campaign song from his 1860 campaign from Abraham Lincoln's. Jim McPherson, author of Tried by War and Abraham Lincoln, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The pride of the sucker, so lucky.